morning. Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting. The website is santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking to Lieutenant General Robert Gard, who is with the Center for Arms Control and Nonproliferation, and he's passing through town and is going to join us on the air. Right now, I'd like to welcome Hank Hughes. He is the Executive Director of the New Mexico Coalition to End Homelessness, and Deborah Tang is with us, too. She's the co-chair of that coalition and also the Executive Director of the St. Elizabeth Shelter. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's great to have you both here. And on a snowy day like this, the issue of homelessness is in people's minds as we're all struggling with the cold and the snow. Your coalition has come up with a plan to end homelessness in Santa Fe in 5 years. Have any other cities ever accomplished this? Are you using other cities as a model?
Well, we are using some other cities. Most cities have 10-year plans to end homelessness. However, in Santa Fe, we already had made some progress, and we thought it made more sense to plan on a five-year time frame, see what we could do in 5 years to end homelessness.
So what are those other cities doing, and how are you following those models?
Well, a lot of cities are moving toward what's called a housing first model of helping the homeless, which means the emphasis is really on getting people into housing as quickly as possible. And that it's also the kind of the centerpiece of our plan. To move more toward really getting people rehoused and back into the community so that they can be stable.
What are the main causes of homelessness?
Poverty is definitely one of the causes, and in Santa Fe particularly is the lack of affordable housing for people, even if they, let's say they have a disability. For a single person, it might be $600 a month is what their check is from Social Security Disability. And yet, they would either have to spend all of it for a very small efficiency or...
And not eat.
Or not even be able to pay. Yeah, right. How would they get their transportation and all the other things that they need? So there are housing vouchers, but there's not enough of them, and there's not enough... affordable housing.
I was reading the report that you all have made, and I think it's important to emphasize that the cause of homelessness in the United States is not as much individual flaw as it is policy. In other words, the homelessness that we see in the United States is a direct result of Reagan-era federal policies.
Well, exactly. Back in the 70s, there was enough housing for everybody, not that it was divided up in the right way. And now there's such a lack of affordable housing that, you know, people at the lower end of the economic scale just don't have housing opportunities available to them, and that's why they end up homeless.
What were some of the changes that happened between the 70s and the 80s?
Well, there was a real cutback in federal housing programs, public housing programs, which can be both, you know, the kind that are owned by public housing authorities, which is generally thought of as public housing, and then the Section 8 vouchers, which is a more recent development, but a very popular program where people can have a voucher and then they can rent an apartment wherever they want to. It's a really good program in that with the vouchers, then people aren't all the poor people aren't crammed into one building. They can be spread out throughout the community, and that works out better for everybody. But unfortunately, you know, the vouchers cost money, and as there's more stress on the federal budget, there's always the pressure to cut these back.
If somebody has a voucher in Santa Fe, is it going to be worth more than if somebody has the voucher in an area where the rents are lower?
Yeah, the vouchers are pegged to the local rents.
So to what extent is Santa Fe's homeless population working people who have fallen, you know, below their ability to afford to rent an apartment versus the sort of stereotypical... alcoholic with a shopping cart who's been living on the street for quite a long time?
I would say that a good majority of the people in our emergency shelter either work full or part-time. A lot of times that's not enough, like they sell papers or do some other jobs that pay very little. And so they just don't have, or it's fewer hours. They only work 20 hours a week or something, and they don't have enough. And a lot of times, people aren't continuously homeless. They're homeless for a period of time. And a lot of people in the shelter actually stay in the shelter, work, so that they can get that first month, last month, deposit, all of that together so that they can move into a place. And that takes time. So,
are most of the people who sell papers on the street as we're driving by homeless people?
Well, some are, and some are formerly homeless. Some have been able to work that into enough money to, you know, get a place. But yeah, I recognize some of them as being homeless or formerly homeless.
To what extent is mental illness part of the problem, and how is it addressed in Santa Fe?
Well, mental illness is definitely a part of the problem, especially for that segment of the homeless population that tends to stay homeless for a longer period of time. The federal government now labels them as the chronically homeless people, and like Deborah said, that's a minority. Some places estimate it's as low as 10% of the whole problem. I'd say it's probably a little higher than that in Santa Fe and New Mexico. But yeah, when you have a mental health problem, you know, then it just compounds all your other problems. You probably can't keep a job. You know, as Deborah said, your Social Security benefits that you get for being disabled aren't really enough to survive on. And then those people also sort of lack the coping skills of, you know, being able to go through all the red tape to get the housing vouchers and food stamps and Medicaid and all the other benefits. And so they really need a lot of help. And so that's where case managers at the shelters, like the case manager at St. Elizabeth's, are really key in leading people through that process of, you know, getting all the benefits they need in order to stay housed and, you know, live in the community.
So St. Elizabeth's is not just about providing food and beds, it's about providing help in the bureaucracy.
Right. And, I mean, we have the emergency shelter that's on at 804 Allred. But we also have three transitional programs. All of those programs, including the emergency shelter and the transitional programs, have case managers that really try and help people maneuver through the system so that they can if they don't already have disability benefits or food stamps or those kinds of things, to be able to get those, help them to stabilize if they need medication or those kinds of things, and to help them find jobs and permanent housing.
We're talking to Deborah Tang and Hank Hughes of the New Mexico Coalition to End Homelessness. In the drafting of this plan, first of all, what is the purpose of this plan? Does it now need to be implemented, approved? I mean, where are we with that?
Well, the plan is was drafted at the request of Mayor Koss, who agreed with us that we needed a plan to end homelessness in Santa Fe. And so the plan is going to the City Council tomorrow night for their endorsement. And the plan does involve a lot of suggestions for the City Council in terms of funding more programs for housing and services. But it's really a plan for the whole community. There's a lot of other aspects to it that people are working on. We've made some, you know, progress already. Deborah's working with a group of people who have, worked on a system for providing emergency overflow shelter beyond what the normal shelters can hold for homeless families and women, which is something we didn't really have before. And the other thing that we're working on is the Santa Fe Community Housing Trust has agreed to develop more rental housing. Previously, they had only done housing for home ownership. Some of the recent actions by the City Council, the Homes Program, has made it a little less necessary for them to build as many affordable homes for sale, so they feel like they can move into the rental area where we've seen a real need for people, not just homeless people, but other people who might be at risk of being homeless, need affordable rental housing in Santa Fe.
Go ahead.
There are other aspects of the plan that don't involve any money whatsoever. One of them was to do interdisciplinary case management, where there's more working together of the social service agencies so that people don't fall through the cracks and that kind of thing. Or if we have a really hard case, we can put our minds together and try and come up with solutions. So those things don't cost money. We just need a place to meet. We've been doing that for about 6 months now since the plan was formulated.
Now, you had homeless and formerly homeless people working on this plan?
Yes.
Yes.
What was the nature of their input as opposed to other people?
Well, I think there were a couple things. We had some people, we had a homeless woman on the committee, still on the committee, who is homeless because of her environmental illness. And she kept reminding us that that's a sort of a unique aspect of homelessness in Santa Fe, is that the people come here because of the clean air if they're environmentally ill, and yet they have trouble finding houses that are clean enough, I guess, for them to live in. And so one of the things we incorporated into the plan is that as we build any new rental housing, we'll try and make it as non-toxic as possible so that people with that particular problem will have a place to live.
And that's tricky business because, of course, the cheapest thing to put on the floor is synthetic carpeting, which is terrible for people with environmental illness.
Right.
Right, right. So it means, you know, that the housing might look a little funny. We'll probably have concrete floors instead, you know, painted concrete maybe. And it also means using things that don't outgas as much formaldehyde as some of the typical building materials.
Now, does Santa Fe, when you look at the sort of economic picture of the city, have the wherewithal to provide enough jobs for everybody who needs to work and wants to work?
Well, I think Santa Fe has a very strong economy. That's part of what draws people here. The service industry, you know, provides a lot of jobs, and so I think sometimes people move here to get a job and then they find out they can't afford the place to live.
So in this city with very high land prices, very high real estate values and so on, how do you get low rent housing implemented? I mean, you know, everybody's going to want to rent their apartment for the very highest price possible.
Well, the plan that we have is we're copying off of something they've done in Denver, Colorado very successfully, would be to build, as we build new apartment complexes, to make them mixed income. So perhaps a third of the units are for homeless or formerly homeless people, and then the other two-thirds would be for people a little bit higher on the income scale. And that way the higher rent apartments can help support the lower rent apartments. But to do that, you still need a lot of subsidy to go into it. So that's part of what we're asking the city for, is to help out, you know, with land or to subsidize some of the construction costs.
Do you run into problems of the sort of not in my backyard thing, people not wanting to live in mixed income, people of the higher incomes not wanting to live in mixed income neighborhoods or apartment complexes?
I don't know that that's the case. I think a lot of times the neighbors, when the project is going up, may have resistance to that. But once it's up, I think it's just, you know, market value.
I think that people are a lot more accepting of housing than they would be of shelters, for example, where the turnover is high. And so, you know, I think the other projects we've built in Santa Fe that we're housing have, you know, the few that we have not encountered a lot of opposition.
We're talking to Hank Hughes and Deborah Tang and about the task force to end homelessness, the plan to end homelessness in Santa Fe. Now, the scope of the actual problem in this town is about 900 people?
Well, that's what we counted on one night last January. And so that we do the count as according to the federal government requirements, which means we have to actually, you know, physically count bodies. So we counted everybody who came in for services on a particular day or was at least on the service rolls. So we know that we missed anybody who wasn't seeking services that day. So 900 is kind of the minimum. We know it's more than that.
And who are these people? What are the demographics?
Well, about 400 of the people we counted were from the Santa Fe Public Schools count of homeless children. And then a good number of the others would be the parents and of those children. We also had you know, a large number of individual people.
And pregnant girls, pregnant teenagers.
Right, right. Well, there would be particularly a lot of teenagers, not all of them pregnant, of course, but.
Well, it was saying in the report that that was a demographic, that was part of the picture of people who are, you know, some of them being in foster care, who get pregnant and suddenly they've got nowhere to go.
Yeah, well, and I think we did concentrate a lot on the problem of homeless youth in the plan because, you know, the way I see it is if we can address people's homelessness early in life, you know, we have a much better chance of helping them get onto a normal type of life later in life.
Now, when you have homeless families, parents, children in the public school system, and so on, are they staying together even though they don't have a proper place to sleep at night?
I think so. I used to have Deborah's job running St. Elizabeth Shelter, and I think my observation at that time was that, you know, the preteen children stayed with their parents almost no matter what. If the parents are still homeless, you know, once the child turns 15, 16 or so, they may choose to try and strike out on their own and see if they can't do a little better. So I don't think we had that many older teenagers in homeless families. They would mostly try it on their own.
And what happens to them?
Well, there's youth shelters and family services that can work with them and counsel them and those kinds of things. But I was going to say that also, you know, right now we have this overflow that we've started for women and children. So if there is a family that needs shelter, mom and children can go to that shelter, and then the men have to go over to Salvation Army. So they do have to split up in overflow.
So what happens next?
Well, next, I mean, tomorrow night we're going to go before the city council and hopefully get their endorsement. I think that the city councilors have all been talking about the plan for a while, and so I'm very optimistic that they're going to vote to endorse it. And then from that point on, I think, you know, we start the hard work of looking at each aspect of the plan and who's going to work on it, and we just have to get down to work.
Is there anything that you want to let the people of Santa Fe know, how they, things they should be aware of and things that they can do?
I would just like to say that we have been at AO4 Allarid for 17 years now. And
St. Elizabeth Shelter.
St. Elizabeth Shelter, the emergency shelter for homeless men, women, and families. And we've had very few minor incidents. It is a safe place to be. Homeless people really feel an attachment to the place and want to make sure that that it continues. And so they really watch each other to make sure that nothing bad happens in the neighborhood. And I think that the Not In My Backyard folks really need to understand that there's no fear to be had with having homeless people in their neighborhoods. And actually, in many of the neighborhoods in Santa Fe, there already are homeless people living in the arroyos, living by the highway, by the freeways, and those kinds of things. And having a place for them to go, to be, is a lot safer than having them just camped out somewhere outside. And so I see the resistance with youth shelters and family services trying to get a drop-in center, and us trying to find a place, a permanent place for the people, the overflow folks that can't come into the shelter because we're full. And so I just wanted to tell Santa Fe that it's important to understand how safe our community is, and that we would make sure and that there would be lots of staff and lots of coverage to make sure that there would be safety for everybody.
And I think there's lots of places for people to plug in to help the homeless in Santa Fe. I mean, besides St. Elizabeth Shelter, which has a really great volunteer program, Youth Shelters and Family Services uses volunteers. There's Esperanza, which is the battered families shelter, and LifeLink and Healthcare for the Homeless. So there's a number of places people can plug in, and of course they can still plug in on our task force if they're interested in the planning and working on that. I think you still probably need some more churches to sign up to host the homeless families during the week. So
Right.
And how do they do that? Is there a number that people can call if they want to get involved?
If they're interested in, if it's a faith community that's interested in doing the overflow for women and children, they can call the main number at St. Elizabeth Shelter, which is 982-6611.
And I guess if they're not sure where they want to plug in and they want to talk to me, they can call me at 982-9000.
982-9000. Well, Hank Hughes and Deborah Tang of the Mexico Coalition to End Homelessness and St. Elizabeth Shelter, thank you very much for being with us, and keep us up to date on what happens at the City Council meeting and beyond.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Mary Charlotte.
We're going to take a break right now, and we'll be speaking to General Robert Gard in a few minutes. Stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like now to welcome retired Lieutenant General Robert Gard. He is a senior military fellow at the Center for Arms Control and Nonproliferation in Washington, D.C., and he's in New Mexico speaking to community groups about his work and to our listeners at KSFR this morning. Welcome.
Happy to be here.
You are in favor of the elimination of nuclear weapons. Considering that they haven't been used in war for over 60 years, why this focus?
Well, because we're obligated by the Nonproliferation Treaty to work toward the elimination. As a practical matter, I don't believe it's likely that they would be eliminated, certainly not in my lifetime and probably not in yours, but we ought to be working in that direction because Article 6 of the Nonproliferation Treaty requires the nuclear weapons states to move in that direction.
What are the forces pushing for that and against the elimination of nuclear weapons?
Well, I would say that there are those, at least in the current administration, who have put nuclear weapons back into the forefront of our national security policy.
This is something I'm very curious about. Does this mean that they actually are seriously considering using them?
Well, that's that's what their national security strategy document and their nuclear posture review document say. They say that nuclear weapons may be used preemptively against states who are developing weapons of mass destruction. They use the word preemption, but in fact, this is preventive war before it becomes an actual threat. Preemptive war is to counter an imminent threat.
So, again, back to the question, what are the forces really for and against the elimination of nuclear weapons?
Well, I think a lot of people recognize that at the present time, we simply do not have the technology that would assure us that other countries, in fact, have eliminated all of their weapons. So I think for the foreseeable future, we will have to keep nuclear weapons as a deterrent against their use by some other power against us. But we certainly don't need 10,000 nuclear weapons for that purpose. We could certainly cut substantially in coordination with the Soviet Union, China, Great Britain, and France.
I've had people on the air who have talked about the reality that the United States and the former Soviet Union, now Russia, still have nuclear weapons pointed at each other on pretty much, what do you call it, high alert? I mean,
yes, I think you're absolutely right. We have some 2,000 weapons on alert. People call it hair trigger alert. It's not quite that. It probably is a 10 to 15 minute alert. But even then, because of the policy of launching on warning, that is, if you see a massive attack coming from, say, Russia, there's a risk that he may knock out substantial numbers of your own retaliatory weapons. So the policy of launching on warnings is to get your weapons in the air before they get hit. And this is a very dangerous situation because the Russian warning systems have deteriorated. They're trying to improve them now with our help, I hope. But nevertheless, this is insane to have 2,000 nuclear weapons pointed at each other.
I mean, insanity is a term that comes up a lot when talking about these weapons of mass destruction, nuclear weapons, just simply because the amount of destruction that they cause is inhuman in a scale that we almost can't fathom.
Yes, it's the only threat to the actual existence and survival of this country.
Really?
Certainly, if thousands...
Global warming doesn't count?
Well, in the long term, but unfortunately, precisely for the reason you described, namely the fact that these weapons are on alert, pointed at each other, that's a near-term threat. It could happen any time.
We're talking to Lieutenant General Robert Gard, who is a senior military fellow at the Center for Arms Control and Nonproliferation. Now, we haven't had a nuclear weapon exploded since Nagasaki, but millions of people die from conventional weapons. There are reasonable estimates that a million Iraqis have died from our weapons in just in the last 4 years. One could make the argument that arms control should really focus on conventional weapon. What's your take on that and your organization, the Center for Arms Control and Nonproliferation?
Well, I don't see these as mutually exclusive. I think we should be working on both.
Are we working on both?
No. In fact, we submarined the negotiations on the illicit trafficking in small arms, partly because of the conviction in this country by many that everybody has a right to carry a weapon, whether he's in the militia or not. And this administration has been disinterested in treaties related to arms control, believing that it reduces its flexibility to take action. And so you see a reluctance on their part even to renew this strategic arms reduction treaty, START 1, which will terminate in, I think it's December 2009. The Russians want a formal treaty with a continuation of inspections and verification. The current administration wants a sort of informal treaty similar to SORT, the treaty we have with Russia that says by 2012 we'll be down to, I believe it's 700 to 1,200 deployed strategic nuclear weapons. And then the treaty terminates at the end, and we can go back to where we are now. It's practically useless. We're not destroying any weapons under that treaty.
I think it's also worth talking about the fact that the arms business is huge business, and there is an interest of the people selling arms to keep conflicts going and to keep people fighting with one another.
Well, I don't know that they have a motivation to keep conflicts going, but they certainly have a motivation to sell these high-priced items. You know, when President Eisenhower warned about the military-industrial complex, the first draft had another word in it: military-industrial congressional complex. You find
really? I've never heard that.
Well, he took congressional out when he actually made the speech. But the fact of the matter is, if you look at the appropriations process in our country, members of Congress will introduce earmarks, so-called earmarks, into the appropriation. That is, authorized expenditures that have not been requested by the administration, nor even vetted by the Congress. They're just placed in. An example is the C-130J, which is a transport aircraft that has so many bugs in it that it cannot be used to transport people or cargo, which is its purpose. But the members of Congress, in whose district or state those jobs exist, simply write in, you got to buy 10 more. That's a real-life example, and it is not the sole example by any means.
Is there any way to effectively deal with that kind of problem?
Oh, I think you'd have to have a very strong chief executive, president, who would be willing to veto bills that had excessive earmarks in them.
So line item veto.
The Congress will never pass that. It was passed.
Well, I mean, that's the problem. Every bill has four gazillion things in it.
Exactly. There are literally thousands of earmarks in these bills.
So if they can't line item veto, how would a chief executive have any power?
He'd have to veto the whole bill and say, send it back to me with half the number of earmarks.
Very interesting. Let's talk about Iraq. We refer to the situation in Iraq as the war in Iraq. My impression is that the United States invaded the country. We captured and executed its head of state. We completely failed to rebuild the infrastructure that we destroyed. And now we're still there fighting a resistance force that is on some level, unfortunately, understandable. I mean, they're resisting this occupation that is us. So what is your understanding of what's going on there and the way out of there?
Well, I think you described it very well. We invaded Iraq with a small, high-tech military force that was trained, as I was when I was in the military, that the job of the military is to destroy the enemy armed force as rapidly as possible with the fewest possible friendly casualties.
Now, friendly casualties.
With the fewest possible friendly
casualties. What's a friendly casualty?
Force protection. Don't let your own people get killed in the process.
Okay.
In fact, force protection has had very high priority. Now, what this connotes is very aggressive offensive operations with a heavy use of firepower to protect your own force instead of going in on the ground with troops. And I'm not criticizing the troops. They did what they were trained to do. So they banged down doors, incarcerated military age males, chased the insurgents around, fired artillery and airstrikes into urban areas, killed, as you rightly say, thousands of Iraqi civilians. And we have so alienated the population that even though currently we are employing a different and appropriate counterinsurgency strategy and tactics, it's too little too late.
In one of your papers, you referred to General Petraeus as a star student brought in to write a term paper after they've been failing the whole year or something like that.
Well, I don't recall having said that, but that's not a bad characterization.
Oh, I thought it was in one of your articles. Anyway.
But it's true that he oversaw the preparation, the counterinsurgency manual, which was issued at the turn of December, January 2007. And we now are actually putting troops into certain sections of Baghdad, so that we are trying to protect the population, which is really the fundamental precept under which a counterinsurgency must operate if it's to be successful. But, as I mentioned, it's too little too late. There was a poll taken just last spring, a USA Today BBC poll, I believe it was. 97% of the Sunnis and 83% of the Shia oppose the presence of U.S. forces in Iraq. Our forces are seen, like the European colonial powers before us were seen, as occupiers. And we're unwelcome.
What do you think is truly the current administration's motive in Iraq?
Not to be tainted with losing a war.
Well, but that's not why they went in.
No, the real reason they went in was to try to remake the Middle East by establishing a kind of Western-oriented free market economy democracy in Iraq that would serve as a symbol. And the assumption of the ideologues that promoted this invasion was that democracy is somehow in the human gene. And as soon as we toppled Saddam, rising from the ashes like a phoenix would be a democratic society. And then we would proceed on to some of the other countries in the Middle East and convert them by force if necessary. That was the plan.
It's hard to believe that that was the plan, because if that's what they had really wanted, they would have rebuilt the infrastructure of Baghdad.
Well, it's awfully hard to have successful infrastructure projects when you don't have any security, and when the insurgents are making certain that your projects don't succeed.
Do you think that's the only reason they didn't succeed? It seems like there's an awful lot of corruption.
Oh, I think there's no doubt, and the current Iraqi government also is highly corrupt. There have been billions of dollars unaccounted for. So I think it was a combination of those two things. And also it's because we simply did not prepare for taking appropriate action following the fall of the government, assuming that it would be a benign situation.
So what do you think is the way out?
Well, more than 2 years ago, a colleague and I at the center wrote a piece trying to compare what might happen if we left Iraq, but what might happen if we stayed. And we came out advocating not cut and run, which is the pejorative term that's used to criticize people who advocate the withdrawal of our combat troops, but a measured, coordinated withdrawal of combat troops, because they're engaged in mission impossible.
We're talking to Lieutenant General Robert Gard, who is a senior military fellow at the Center for Arms Control and Nonproliferation in Washington, D.C. The majority of the people in the United States, according to pretty much any poll that I've read lately, want the war in Iraq to end, but it's not ending. Where's the disconnect between the will of the people and what's actually happening?
It's an administration very similar to Lyndon Johnson during the Vietnam War that does not want to be tainted with losing the war. So they continue on. This is reminiscent of Vietnam in the spring of 1968. Robert McNamara, the Secretary of Defense, as you can see in the documentary Fog of War,
which is a great movie.
It is. Had told President Johnson that the war was unwinnable. President Johnson knew it was hopeless from the beginning, if you listen to any of his tapes. And they didn't know what to do, so they surged in the spring of 68. We increased the number of troops by 25,000. At that point in time, there had been 24,000 Americans killed in action. 5 years later, by continuing on, there were 34,000 more killed in action.
Not to mention the number of Vietnamese, which was...
In Iraq,
the body count of Iraqis to Americans is somewhere between 200 and 300 to 1.
Nobody really knows, but I would say certainly it's probably more than 100,000 killed.
It's a million killed. I mean, The Lancet estimated 650,000.
Well, you get all sorts of different estimates, but it's very high, and it's precisely the cause of the alienation of the Iraqi people.
Well, let's move over to Iran. Where do we stand today in the United States with Iran, given that the recent news a few days ago that they have not had a nuclear weapons program for several years now?
Well, we stand where we did until September 05 in North Korea. We refuse to negotiate with the Iranians unless they take action to give us the result we want of the negotiations, namely the suspension of their uranium enrichment program, before we're willing to talk. Now, that's a weird kind of diplomacy. We finally, with the North Koreans, have agreed that we would go step by step, concession by concession, and we're making progress. They've shut down the Yongbong reactor. The Iranians are not breaking the non-proliferation treaty by enriching uranium. They have a perfect right to do so, even though we were able to get a UN Security Council resolution asking them to stop. But as the Iranian ambassador to the International Atomic Energy Agency said just a few days ago, we suspended uranium enrichment for a year and a half, and we got nothing in return. We would be willing to do it again if there might be some outcome that would be desirable for the country. There have been overtures from Iran to this country to engage in negotiations, which the administration has spurned. And it's just nonsensical to refuse to talk.
The difference between the level of uranium enrichment that you need to run a nuclear power plant and the level of uranium enrichment that you need to make a bomb is gigantic. It's a few percent in for a nuclear power plant. It's like over 90% for a nuclear weapon.
Well, the dividing line between low enriched uranium, from which you cannot produce an explosion, and high enriched uranium is considered to be 20%. Now, if you only have 20% enrichment, you would need one huge device. So you're quite correct. Most of the highly enriched uranium used in bombs is enriched to about 90%.
Now, so that's a huge difference, and I'm wondering if that makes a difference in one's ability to negotiate with another country. I mean, can't you sort of tell which?
Well, it's hard to, because the same process is used to produce 5% enrichment, which is all you need for a power plant. And all you need to do is run it through the centrifuges.
10 times as long.
Ramp up the speed and leave it in there much, much longer, as you say. As of now, the best estimates are that the Natanz facility in Iran is not capable of producing highly enriched uranium, but they keep working on it. And even though, according to the Non-Proliferation Treaty, there's no violation in enriching uranium, the problem is the potential for what El Baradei, the director of the IAEA, calls breakout. Namely, if you develop the capability to enrich uranium to a relatively high level, or even if you have the facility to do so and you only have low enriched uranium, you can declare that you're withdrawing from the Non-Proliferation Treaty for reasons of supreme urgency. And then you can take your low-enriched uranium and run it through the centrifuges, and you've got the material to make a weapon. So we need to take action to reconfigure the entire non-proliferation regime. We're at something of a tipping point now, just as we were in the 60s when the non-proliferation treaty was negotiated. Now we need to modify it so we can prevent breakout. El Baradei says some 50 nations have the capability, should they elect to do so, to break out in that same manner. That's what the North Koreans did. They used plutonium, not highly enriched uranium.
I think there's an international perception of the United States at this point that we don't practice what we preach. The nuclear is only part of that. But if the United States were to actually hold up its end of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty in practice and in spirit, do you think that would make a difference in setting a model?
I certainly do. There's no question. I mean, take the recent agreement with India. It's contrary to our own laws to provide assistance to countries that don't comply with the non-proliferation treaty requirements for inspection. India is not even a member of the non-proliferation treaty, and we proceeded because of the administration's view that nuclear weapons really aren't the problem. The problem is who has them. The Blue Ribbon Commission that was constituted by President Kennedy in the 1960s, and it was genuinely a Blue Ribbon Commission. Roswell Gilpatrick chaired it. It had John McCloy, other notables, concluded that the possession of nuclear weapons, even by allies of the United States, was a threat to United States security. In other words, weapons were the problem. This administration is saying the regime is the problem, which then leads you to say regime change should be the way to deal with this, not establishing standards that would prevent the proliferation of the weapons. It is really a counterproductive policy that hopefully the next administration will reverse.
Now, it seems to me, and I'm speaking as a woman here, is that it's a lot easier to come to the resolution of problems through talking than through fighting. And, you know...
You don't have to speak as a woman to come to that conclusion. I agree with you.
Well, I just wonder if your group is you know, trying to work on envisioning a world system based on negotiation. I mean, given that, you know, we just, before you came on the air, we had the people on from the task force to end homelessness talking about people who don't even have two pennies to rub together walking around the streets of Santa Fe on a snowy day like this. And then we're talking about these colossal wastes of money where if they're not used, they're a waste, and if they are used, they're a waste of life, namely weapons. I mean, just the whole system in its fundamental nature seems terribly flawed and inhuman.
Well, I have to say and that I agree with you. I was saying yesterday to my colleague, Leonor Tamaro, who's here with me, that I have really become jaded about the operations of our government in Washington with the earmarks, and in particular because of my special interest in international security and foreign affairs, our failure, as you just said, to negotiate. After all, what's diplomacy about? It is to open the dialogue with a nation with which you have a disagreement, with the objective of having a result that is beneficial to both sides. And if you refuse even to talk, you have no chance for that sort of outcome. And for the entire first administration of the current administration, Bush's first term, we refused to talk to the North Koreans. We insisted that they have a complete, verifiable, irreversible disestablishment of their nuclear program before we'd even talk with them. Now, finally, we reversed that policy, and we now are proceeding on a action-by-action process, and that's precisely the way we should move with the Iranians.
Well, on that note, unfortunately, we have to go. I want to thank you so much for being here with us on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
It's delightful to be here. I love your city.
Thank you. Lieutenant General, retired Lieutenant General Robert Gard is a senior military fellow at the Center for Arms Control and Nonproliferation in Washington, D.C., and he is in New Mexico this week. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're also podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Laurel Reynolds for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, the Jazz Experience. Broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. We'll see you tomorrow. Ciao.